You are outside your mind.
Yeah, cuckoo.
This isn't playtime. This is serious business.
Well, the play must go on, I believe.
I'm always home. I'm on cool.
I've been thinking a lot about dying lately.
I'm trying to do good.
That's that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of That's That, a Philip Seymour Hoffman retrospective podcast. My name is Timothy Mark Davis, and I'm your host. Today, we are talking about Moneyball, the 2011 biography sports drama written by Steven Zaillian and Aaron Sorkin, directed by Bennett Miller, and starring Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill, Karis Dorsey, Robin Wright, Chris Pratt, Stephen Bishop, and a nearly bald but just buzzed and beautiful Philip Seymour Hoffman. I hope you took time to watch the film on Netflix because it is, first of all, it's an outstanding movie. And second of all, our man Phil brings so much presence. Even though he has so little to say, there's so much presence in his performance. My guest today is friend, collaborator, playwright, and Moneyball fanatic, Stephen Fran Smith. Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing great, man. How are you doing?
Oh, so good. So glad we're talking about this movie.
Oh, God, I'm so happy to.
Yes, Moneyball, which features Philip Seymour Hoffman as Art Howe, the steely, no-nonsense manager of the Oakland Athletics. Here is the logline from IMDb. Oakland A's general manager Billy Beane's successful attempt to assemble a baseball team on a lean budget by employing computer-generated analysis to acquire new players. Here's the logline from Netflix. Frustrated that his baseball team can't afford big money players, Oakland A's general manager Billy Beane bets on a bold new strategy to change the game. We had some alliteration folks over at Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix really nailed that one. That was good.
Yes, they did. Billy Beane bets on a bold new strategy. I would agree. I prefer the Netflix one. What's your take on these loglines?
Yeah, I mean, the first one was shit, just absolute shit, and the Netflix one really cooked me, even more so than I am after watching the movie about 100 times.
Oh, my God. Now, I'm just curious, we will get into your origin story with this movie, but did you watch it again in preparation for this podcast?
I don't need to watch it again, Tim. I live this movie.
I live Moneyball. Incredible. All right, let's jump into the factoid dump. Now that we've agreed that the Netflix logline is vastly superior to the IMDb one. IMDb, I think it's just like user trolls, and whoever gets the most upvotes gets. It's just ridiculous. Get a real writer, IMDb. If you're out there, you can hire myself and Stephen Fran Smith for $1,000 an hour. That's for the both of us. So it's a 2-for-1 deal, basically. So as mentioned, Moneyball was directed by Bennett Miller, whose other notable directing credits include the 2005 Capote, in which Philip Seymour Hoffman won his only Oscar for Best Actor, and the 2014 Foxcatcher, which is Steve Carell being wild. Oh my gosh, that's a horrifying performance. Fun fact, Miller and Hoffman had been friends since they were teenagers and had often
really?
Talked about collaborating together. Yeah, they knew each other. I want to say that I think the origin story is that Bennett Miller went to some theater camp or film camp at NYU while Philip Seymour Hoffman was a student there, and they became friends or something like that. So they've known each other a very, very long time.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Good little factoid there. Also notably, the film was written by Steven Zaillian and Aaron Sorkin. Zaillian's writing credits include, my God, Schindler's List, Gangs of New York, American Gangster, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and The Irishman. No big deal. He's a 5-time Best Screenplay nominee, a 1-time winner for Schindler's List. Aaron Sorkin was the other writer on the film. Apparently, this was like a Steve Zaillian script that was out there, and then it got a Sorkin touch-up. Maybe you know more about that.
I do.
Than I do. Okay, great. So we'll get that origin story after the factoid dump. I love that. But Aaron Sorkin, I'm sure all of you know, A Few Good Men, The West Wing, Charlie Wilson's War, which is an amazing Hoffman performance.
Oh, yeah.
Social Network, The Newsroom, Steve Jobs, Molly's Game, and most recently, The Trial of the Chicago 7, which I really enjoyed. Sorkin is a 3-time Best Screenplay nominee and 1-time winner for The Social Network, which is a perfect movie.
It is. I agree.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. But we're not here to talk about David Fincher and The Social Network. We're here to talk about the fact that this film, Moneyball, has a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, if that matters to you. But that's pretty high compared to the last several films we have talked about on the podcast. Estimated budget size of $50 million. It's another one of those rare Hollywood dramas with that budget size in our current filmmaking landscape. That's not a they don't make movies for $50 million and try to make $100 million on them anymore. You only make movies for $200 million and make $1 billion. That is the Hollywood landscape. But here we have Moneyball, although it was 2011. So God only knows what's going on now. What are we saying? It's a pandemic. There is no film industry. Storytelling is dead. We're in the wrong profession, Stephen. I'm about to go on a rant, but I'm going to stop myself and get back on script. The film was shot in the summer of 2010 throughout California and a little bit of Arizona. It premiered on September 9th, 2011 at the Toronto Film Festival and went on to a wide release in the U.S. beginning September 23rd. A few other notable facts and pieces of trivia that I found interesting. Billy Bean is portrayed as a lonely divorcee. In real life, he had remarried. Scenes were shot with Catherine Morris as his second wife, Tara. They didn't make the final cut. They are included in the Blu-ray extras, but Brad Pitt's character is wearing a wedding ring throughout the film, which I did notice. Amazing that you can have a whole marriage just cut out of a film and it still
totally
works. Oh, it's just filmmaking is truly incredible for that reason. You can just remove entire storylines and somehow there is still cohesion. So here's a little tidbit that you can add on to, Stephen. When Aaron Sorkin agreed to rewrite the screenplay, he stated as a condition that Steven Zaillian's name would not be removed from the credits because his draft was great and Sorkin didn't really feel he could improve it that much.
Wow.
Then
really?
Why did they hire him? What's your knowledge of this story?
So I read the scripts for The Social Network and Moneyball back to back. And, you know, with The Social Network, he wrote a bigger draft than what you saw in the film. And then David Fincher was very strict with cutting it down and only getting exactly what they needed. And, and so like the script that you can read online is the script after David Fincher went in and did his own kind of surgery to it.
Yeah.
So, but then I read the Moneyball script, I think before Aaron Sorkin got his hands on it, and it is just a total disaster of a film.
What?
It is it's so strange. Like it doesn't resemble it at all, to be honest. Like there's all these like little weird little narratives going on in it. And I felt like either Aaron Sorkin would have had to have rewritten it entirely, or they just shot it and then edited it completely out of sequence with how the screenplay is written.
Well, it's interesting because it has that Sorkin conciseness to it.
It does.
You know, like the way it moves from scene to scene, there's just no fat. It's very lean. But in the best way, which I feel like Aaron Sorkin is kind of the best at. So I was surprised to read this piece of trivia, but now I wonder if Aaron Sorkin had to contractually say that in an interview because it was just like a nightmare disaster. They had to save face or something.
Like you really know that Aaron Sorkin must have rewritten it substantially because it feels somewhat like a play. Like so many of the scenes are longer. Mm. They're more dialogue based. And Sorkin started as a playwright and you can see that in pretty much everything that Sorkin does is there, very dialogue.
Which is probably why I'm so attracted to it because he does that dialogue heavy stuff so well.
It's lyrical. It's like music.
Yeah. It's awesome. So before we get into the film more, I'm sure we'll expand on what we've already talked about. My last tiny little factoid that I thought was worth mentioning is that Spike Jonze is uncredited in this film, but he plays Alan, Robin Wright's new husband.
In the very best scene of the film.
Yes. He's such a little dork. He's such a little weenie. Oh, it's hilarious.
And what's also great, so that is a scene that my best friend and I constantly quote to each other, even though almost nothing happens in the scene. It's just so lovely. See, like one, knowing that, I think the story goes that like Spike Jonze wasn't even supposed to play that role, but he was like around and they were like, hey man, do you want to play this like one scene stepdad role?
Oh my gosh.
And he knocks it out of the park. The other really funny thing is when, you know, some things that they, I think they cut out are showing like how kind of violent Billy Bean is with himself. They do it a couple of times where he throws a chair against the wall.
Yeah, he like throws chairs and flips a table.
He flips his desk. But yeah. But apparently, like when he was really suffering as a baseball player and just failing, I think he once he once struck out and then broke his bat and then was so mad with himself that he went out to bat again with the broken bat.
Oh my god.
And so knowing that Robin Wright's character was married to him during that time, and for him to show up at the house and he's like, how's it going, Alan? And he's like, oh, things are very peaceful around here.
Yes.
Like, peaceful is such a very specific word to use.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Because of what now we know Robin Wright must have been through.
That's funny because there's a flashback scene where 80s player Billy Bean, he breaks his bat over his leg. It's like a slow-mo montage-y thing. He breaks his bat over his leg and he goes in the dugout and he's like all pissed off. So I wonder if that was in the script or they talked about it on set and he probably knew that when he was writing it, whoever wrote that word. Peaceful. That's so good. Okay. So Stephen, what are your overall thoughts, feelings, and impressions of Moneyball? And a part of that answer, give us your Moneyball origin story, because it's a little different and extreme than some of the other guests we've had on the podcast. Probably not since I did the Master episode with my brother has there been someone who has seen the movie as many times and are so obsessed with it. Like my brother and I are obsessed with that movie. We quote it to each other all the time. You have a similar relationship with this film. So give us your impressions of the film and give us your Moneyball origin story.
So, you know, my origin story is that I remember watching it when it came out and I liked it. Definitely. I didn't, you know, I wasn't over the moon about it. It wasn't my favorite film. But I definitely liked it. And then what happened was that during that time, you know, I was new to New York. I was pursuing, you know, my lifetime goal of being a playwright. And I had just kind of written
which
my
you
first,
are now, by the
which
way.
I am now. I'm a playwright. But I had just written my first like play that was a play, right? Where people were interested in it. I was starting to like have my first dreams become real as a playwright. And immediately after that, I put a lot of pressure on myself to like catapult myself to the next level in my playwriting career. And I put so much pressure on myself that I ended up falling into a devastating state of writer's block, for 2 years. Ugh. And during this time, during like the lowest part of that, where, you know, I had tried all these different tactics for how to get out of it, maybe like a year and a half or so in, I was at my lowest point. And I was at that point where, like, you know, that level of depression where all you want to do is sleep because being awake is so bad. I was at that state. And the only thing that I could do while I was awake was watch the movie Moneyball. And I don't know why that was the movie I turned on, but I turned it on and it was just such a comforting feeling watching it. Like I enjoyed it so much that I literally watched it maybe 3 or 4 times a day, every single day for 2 to 3 months during the darkest period.
God.
And it really was like a saving grace for me.
Yeah.
It was just like so great. And I think like looking back on it, why I enjoy that movie so much is because there is a certain level of like charm to a lot of the characters throughout that makes you feel good. I mean, one, Brad Pitt being the lead.
Yeah.
Just being extremely charming in everything that he's doing.
Gorgeous.
Just a wonderful man.
Yes.
And then two, you know, there's something about the film where there's actually like very few outbursts of emotion in the film.
Yeah.
Everybody's emotions are very muted. And I think because of that, like, it couldn't startle me in my depressive state. I think like it was a very very peaceful watching experience.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack to it gives it this like slow momentum building and building, very slowly. That's just kind of like taking care of you the whole way through, you know? I feel like those are my biggest impressions of the film, are like definitely very funny, inspirational story, because it's like two guys going against the system to do something that they hope will work, right? Yeah. And they're failing throughout, which is very important. And then like they ultimately, you know, are kind of proven right.
Kind of
proven right.
Yeah. That is something that kind of surprised me. I have trouble explaining why the film feels so successful. I do think the daughter stuff is a part of that.
Yeah.
And the sort of resolution that's there and the lyrics to that song. But also it's like somehow in this scene where, okay, they have an 11-0 lead and then the team comes all the way back and ties it. Somehow they make this home run, this Hattaburg home run, seem so important and so dramatically set. And part of it is, I mean, this. Like that song.
Oh.
The mighty Rio Grande. I don't even know what it's called. That song is so good. I've listened to that song like 10 times since watching this movie a few days ago, because it makes me feel so good. And they play that song so when he's doing this home run. And it's like the stakes don't feel that high, but then somehow they're also the way it's edited and everyone's reaction. It's so high. I don't know, man.
Well, they're, I mean,
impressive.
The stakes in that moment of the film are they're going for the 20th win. They're going for the record.
Right. But it seems like, so I don't know. It's like,
well, if
it's
they,
not
if
like
they get the
I
record, if they get the record, then they will have been proven right. Right.
Yeah. I guess that connection does occur.
Like that is the most important thing. Also in real life, like that game was incredibly thrilling and like such a roller coaster. Like it wouldn't have been as successful if they had just like scored 11 runs and then they just won the game. The game actually plays out like it does in the movie, where they scored shitload of runs in the first couple innings, and then the other team came all the way back until the final inning. Like it's crazy.
So crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy that it ended that way. But I think the reason the movie is successful is because they paint the conflict as, what do you do when, you know, you're a small market team and you have no money and all your players are constantly bought out.
Yeah.
Like what do you do to invest and make that team successful? And Billy Bean goes against all these obstacles, all of the traditional thinking of the day, to do something where he is chastised, he is maligned, he fails a whole lot. And it's actually not that they won that 20th win in a row. It's actually not that they got the record. It's that at the very end, when he is being given the option to be bought out by the Boston Red Sox, it's that he decides to go back.
Yeah.
You know, like that's the final thing.
Yeah.
Like that's why the movie climax is so brilliant, is because Aaron Sorkin builds in all of these little conflicts throughout, and then slowly like resolves them.
Yeah. I feel like the film, it's this weird thing where I don't feel like I see many films these days where it's this like man versus self thing, to put it in like seventh grade storytelling terms, where this character has so much turmoil going on inside and the conflict is properly and not cheesily externally communicated through his work relationships, through his career, through his personal relationships with his daughter. And these things are resolved or, resolved. Not necessarily that it's a happy ending in every sense, but everything is resolved and it like works and it's not cheesy and it's like there's no hokey exposition. It just like captures someone's internal struggle, but with a little more commercialized feel. Like you can feel that this is a $50 million
right
movie. It's not like us making a $50,000 indie drama about a guy who's like trying to do something, but he can't because conflict, you know, this like is a true drama. It's got the sports thing, but it's not about sports. You know, that is the backdrop. That's the environment for this protagonist's struggle against himself.
Yeah.
What are you trying to say?
I'm saying it doesn't matter what moves I make if you don't play the team the way they're designed to be played.
Billy, you're out of your depth.
Let's talk about the Philip Seymour Hoffman performance.
Beautiful.
Because that is technically what we're here to do. as much as I could probably just talk about Moneyball, this was such a... I guess the last thing I'll say before we go on to the Hoffman performance... I watched this a few nights ago and it made me feel so good. And I totally understand why this became your depression film.
Why?
Just like the feeling that the movie creates.
Yeah.
It's like truthful to the human experience, but it's not a tragedy. I don't know. It hits some tone storytelling wise that is very accessible and very universal and uplifting, but not sugar-coated. And so it feels like it honors someone's pain, but it also gives hope and encourages resilience and encourages sticking, you know, stick-to-itness, for lack of a better term.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an underdog story, you know, it's a buddy comedy.
Yeah.
That's an underdog story and it's a real sports story. It's like, what more do you want?
Yeah, it's true.
You have Brad Pitt. Most charming person alive.
Yep.
And for some reason, in a role that they did not need to cast the greatest actor of the last 20 years,
I know.
They happened to cast Philip Seymour Hoffman as a coach or a manager who had maybe four scenes of dialogue.
I know. It's such a like, Philip Seymour Hoffman is just like at the peak of his powers and popularity. And, you know, to me, we've talked about this previously on the podcast where Phil worked with directors multiple times. This was his second time working with Bennett Miller. They were friends. Like he valued good collaboration and good relationship more than getting the lead role or being the lead role or having, you know, ex writer, director, producer write him a vehicle. He would rather be a part of a story that was really meaningful to him.
Yeah.
And I want to play a clip really quick that I think captures, you know, why would Philip Seymour Hoffman at this stage in his career, when he's already won an Oscar, he's got other nominations, you know, he is one of the most celebrated actors or character actors for people who use that term ever. And probably the most at that time in history, why would he do this film? And I think it had a little something to do with this.
I find it inspiring that there's a guy who, you know, in the middle of his life all of a sudden like turns back into his life and looks at it and becomes obsessed with having to deal with what came before. I think that's inspiring. That he is now, you almost feel like he is now going to Groundhog Day himself until that day is gone. And he can sit in the stands and watch the game, you know, that he can, you know what I mean? That he can enjoy a baseball game again, that he can enjoy his life again, but he is obsessed with having to somehow turn and look back into it. I think it's very inspiring. And I think that that's what's so hard about the conflicts in the film is that no one can actually say that. do you know what I mean? Like, Billy Bean can't walk into my office and go, listen, I'm looking back at my life, and I would like to try, you know, oh, Billy, that's too much for me, you know. But I do think that you know, whenever we talked about the film, that's sort of the human side of it was that, and that's very inspiring because I think all of us are kind of at that point in our lives, you know, and I think that speaks to us. That does speak to me.
I just, you know, something that is so true throughout his career is he was interested in the story that was being told.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter, like, whether the role being offered him was the lead, was the, you know, strong supporting role, like Jonah Hill's character, or was just like a foreseen foil to the protagonist. Like, if he believed in the overall story, that was the thing that compelled him to be a part of the project. And that just seems kind of uncommon to me. You know, it seems like a lot of actors of his pedigree and popularity would just be looking for the lead role.
Yeah. And you know, I kind of feel like after a certain kind of achievement in your career, you know, like something that I hear a lot of artists that I know talk about, like now that I'm in my 30s and now that, you know, people I know have been around doing stuff for a little while longer, mm-hmm. they're really just looking to do work with people that they like.
Yeah.
Because when you're in a room with artists that you don't know and you're not sure how they're going to react, or like you have certain people who are prima donnas or certain people that are difficult to work with or certain people that you just don't vibe with, it sucks. It sucks.
It's the worst.
And like I that's one of the things that I love Philip Seymour Hoffman in is so many of the movies where he's really great, he's actually not the lead. He's a supporting mm-hmm. character. I mean, in Magnolia, in Punch mm-hmm. Drunk Love, in Boogie Nights. He's incredible in Boogie yeah. Nights.
Oh my God, yeah. You know, Ethan Hawke, I've said this before, but Ethan Hawke talked to him as like the first fully actualized actor artist of my generation is the phrase that he used. And it's like a, you know, very dense phrase, but I think it really just means someone who's like ultimately they are a servant to storytelling. They are not a servant to themselves and not a servant to even the craft of acting. That's his tool. That's his craft. That's his art. That's the thing that he is perfecting and working to get better at. But it fits into the larger purpose of the storytelling arts. You know, these people who are us who have committed our lives to trying to make the world a better place, make people more empathetic, make ourselves more empathetic. Plugging into that sort of eternal tradition, eternal project, rather than your own vanity, which is so easy to do, and we're all doing it on the daily. But plugging into that eternal tradition of storytelling, God, that is just like, that is clearly his engine. And for me, it's inspired me as an actor and as a director, as a producer, you know, whatever I'm kind of trying to do, that's the thing I'm continually trying to plug myself into. Because getting caught up in the other stuff, getting caught up in the prima donna stuff, or, you know, the vanity projects, that's just, you're always so close to serving that side of yourself. Plugging back into that eternal project is huge for me.
Yeah, I know. I remember when I first got to New York, I heard about this production of, I think it was Othello, that was going on at the Labyrinth Theater Company.
Yeah.
Where he was one of Iago. The artistic directors. And apparently, I was interning at this company and they knew, like a bunch of people who worked there knew him. And they were all going to see the show. And I was like really jealous because I, you know, was obsessed with him. And they came back the next day and I was like, wow, how was it? They were like, it was so bad. It was a terrible play.
Yeah, that is like his worst. That's like his worst reviewed show he's ever been a part of.
Really?
Yeah, that's like known to be. I even think that he received some negative reviews, which was pretty rare. Yeah. I mean, I guess his Death of a Salesman was a little mixed. Which is so offensive to me because I actually saw that show. So really? If anyone wants to come fight me about his Death of a Salesman, don't, because I will get violent. But yeah, his Iago and just that whole production was not reviewed very well from my research.
Right, but that was also like he had already won an Oscar then, you know, and he was going to do a show in New York that I'm sure he actually probably didn't get paid for that since he was one of the artistic directors, or he probably at least took a huge pay cut to do it.
Oh, definitely.
But I think that plays into that feeling of like just doing good work that he believes in, even if sometimes it fails.
Yep. Yep, definitely. All right, I'm going to play this Jonah Hill clip.
So Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Brad Pitt is like the coolest guy ever. He's an iconic figure, and I worship all of his movies, specifically his performance in True Romance and Snatch and Fight Club. Those are like my three of my favorite performances ever. Snatch is my favorite performance of his. I think he's like remarkable in that movie. But you know, I worship that guy. But Philip Seymour Hoffman to me, he's just unfucking real, dude. Like, there is just not an actor like that in the universe. I mean, you know, my heroes are Dustin Hoffman and Bill Murray, but the modern day Dustin Hoffman and Bill Murray, in my opinion, are John Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Those are the guys. And the reason why Dustin Hoffman and Bill Murray are my heroes is because they do comedy and drama seamlessly. So do Phil and John C. Reilly. So, you know, Phil is so fucking good at acting that he hates my character and he hates Brad's character in the movie. So a funny story from the movie is I would see on the call sheet, which is like when they say who's there that day, because Brad and I were there like every day and we would see who was there each day, and we'd see Phil Hoffman's name on the call sheet, and every time I would see his name on there I would go, shit. Because he hates my character in the movie, and so whenever he's there I know I'm doing a scene with him, and he's so good at acting it feels like he genuinely hates you in the scene. So you're doing the scene and you're like, this guy fucking hates me, he's so mad at me. And a few days we would eat lunch together, and halfway through lunch I'd go, Phil, you're not mad at me like that, right? You know, you go, no, I'm just acting, man. You're a great guy, you know? Like, so that was funny because, you know, it really was Phil, when he got there, I during the rehearsals and stuff, I just, I mean, he's so intense and so raw.
So, the thing that this Jonah Hill clip, when he's talking about, like, you know, I thought that the character in the movie hates my character so much, it felt like he hated me. Like, it was just so raw and intense and real. And I went back and, you know, as I was watching the scenes and thinking about Phil's performance, the thing that stuck out to me is that this is someone who has so few lines, even the scenes he's in, maybe it's three or four, but he has so few lines, but my God, he is horrifying. Like, just the weight of his presence, and like whenever he moves an arm, whether it's like hand on the hips or crosses his arms, like his face is so fixed. It's like cemented jello or something. It's so intense looking and scary looking. And then he just is like, like he just like mumbles out the lines.
It seems from the expression on his face that there's so much he wants to say, but is not saying.
Oh my God, yes.
And I think that is the really like great part of his acting in this role, is because he's given so few lines and he has to come across as kind of like the villain. And he like never gets angry either. He never like yells at anybody. He never like makes a stand really. He's always
the loudest thing he says is like, are you out of your mind?
Oh yeah.
Like, that's the most intense he gets.
I forgot about that. Yeah, it's like he tries to convey so much more than what he's given. And I think that's like one of the greatest things that he does in the role.
It is. And it's interesting because there's some, just like the way he approaches every role he's played so differently always astounds me. You know, sometimes he is this like overly expressive, whether it's like a positive or negative, you know, it could be fully flamboyant character, like something from Flawless or Boogie Nights, or just like the rage and the anger, like Punch Drunk Love,
right,
or Charlie Wilson's War. There's just like this, he terrorizes the other people who he's acting with. But then he's got these roles like Moneyball, where it is so understated. It's so subtle. And this one in particular, he just puts so much in his face. He puts so much in his body. There's this tension that's there. And like you said, it's like it's communicating so much more just through the way he looks and then the way he sounds than his words allow him to do.
Like if you look at his posture, he's always like folding his arms really close to his body. He's so tense. He's just like a little ball of intensity.
Yep. And he's in those baseball pants. He's like always like tight clothes and
he looks really uncomfortable all the time.
Yeah. Yep. He does.
You know what's incredible? There's this one moment in the movie that always catches me. And I think it goes to like why he's so great. And I think it's because he's so detail oriented with everything that he does. It's at the end of the movie when it's the final game where they're playing for their 20th win. And Scott Hatterberg is up and he's batting and he hits the ball. And there's that long stretch of seconds where the ball is flying in the air, you know?
Yep.
And Chris Pratt, who plays Scott Hatterberg, is watching it. And then Jonah Hill, you see him in the stands. He's watching it go.
Yep.
And everyone stands up. But then it goes to Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. And his eyes do this back and forth thing as he's watching it. And it's just the tiniest detail. But you can tell he's looking at the ball and at the stands and then at the ball and then back at the stands to see if it's going to go. And I feel like any other actor would just watch the ball. Just watch the ball if it goes up. That's all you really need to do. But he's just so detailed in that tiny moment.
Yeah.
And it gives me like a little flicker of like, oh my gosh, is this going to happen in the moment?
Mm-hmm.
It's that little detail that I'm like, God, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. God, that didn't register. Now that you say it, I remember that.
Yeah. Cause you haven't seen the movie 80 times.
No, I think I've only seen it. I've definitely seen it twice, maybe three times. I'm definitely going to watch it more. My wife didn't watch it with me this time, and she's seen it before, but I was like, I think we need to watch this movie next week because it's just so feel good, like around Thanksgiving time. It's the insane thing. We talked about this in the Ides of March episode 2, where it's like these tiny details. I'm just like, how does he do that? Where are the ideas? Like, is it just pure? He gets on set and he's in the creative flow and there's just an intuition. And all of a sudden he realizes like, oh, I should like look back and forth and like look like I'm looking between the ball and the stands. And it's just something in the moment that he finds, or is this in the preparation, the hours of preparation where he's doing the voice and body work and, you know, scoring his script, and God knows what that man did when he was studying a script. Oh, I would love to know more than anything on earth. I would give an arm to know how that man dealt with his scripts.
I think it's just intuition. I think he just
knows. Something like that, it would be insane to prepare.
Right?
Like, oh, it's just... it's so, 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 so good.
And I think the other fascinating thing about it is like just thinking about the movie in general, you know, I think so much of it works because Brad Pitt playing Billy Bean is just such a charming, charming guy in everything that he does. Because like the way he treats Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, he's kind of a dick to him.
Yeah, he is a little bit.
You know, like at the very beginning.
But he never he holds off. That was something that I was impressed with. He holds off strong arming him. Like he never forces him to play the roster. He tells him, this is how you need to play it. This is how you're going to do it. And then Art Howe doesn't do it that way. And Billy Bean gets really mad, but he doesn't fire him. He doesn't say, he doesn't force him. You know, it's like Art Howe has the lineup. That is how this works.
Right.
Ultimately, he does then... I'm just going to trade away the players and force you, which is such a power move.
Right, it's kind of like the most passive aggressive thing you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. There is this sort of faux politeness that he has with him that underneath it is just like, fuck you, man.
Right. I think
you got to play the team this way.
Got it. It's because if you just look at the lines on the page for the script, it's like their first interaction. Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is like, hey, listen, you only gave me a 1-year contract. I think we know what that means. And I just gave you like a great winning season. And Brad Pitt is essentially like, fuck you. I'm going to go get some players.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. He is, they do a really good job of setting up the history that we don't even get to know, the history of the conflict, the at oddsness of these two characters. And I love the way too, there's a couple little clips that I found where Phil talks about his character. So I'm going to play those really quick.
My character thinks he's right. So, you know, so he's saying, I don't agree with you. So they disagree, you know. So it wasn't much of a wrestler. I just think I'm right. The character thinks he's right.
I love that clip because it's so short and it's basically a reporter. Like the question is like, oh, why is your character that way? Or why are you mean? Why are you the bad guy? And Phil has this little bit of tone of like, just like, okay, I'm going to explain what acting is to someone for the like 10,000th time. My character thinks he's right. It's like, that's what it is. It's not personal. It's just acting. My character thinks he's right. That's how this works.
Well, it's interesting because his character is right. I mean, it would be like, you know, if we're going to do a show and somebody came up to you as a producer or something, and they're like, hey, I'm going to throw out the entire script. And we're just gonna, like we're gonna improvise the Crucible. We don't need.
Oh my God!
To learn the lines, and you're like, that's a terrible idea.
It's absolutely no, not happening ever.
We can't do that.
That will never happen. I am Art Howe. That will never happen.
Right, exactly.
I have the lineup.
It's like, no, you're wrong.
Yeah, no, that
you can't improvise the Crucible. The Crucible is a great play. That's an awful idea.
I play Art Howe, but not really Art Howe. You know, it's the manager of the team, and I'm the foil in a way. I'm the guy that's you know, the wall that Billy's got to break through. You know, and I serve that purpose.
It's just like another question of like, who do you play? Who do you play in the movie? And I was reading. Apparently, Art Howe had some issues with how he was portrayed.
Big time.
Yeah, so what I saw was like Philip Seymour Hoffman is great. He was great, but I was not portrayed the way that this actually happened, which I thought was a funny line for him to draw. Do you know anything about Art Howe? He's like a famous coach, from my understanding.
Yeah, he's like a really good coach. And he apparently all the stuff they had him do, that's not at all how it happened. he wasn't against Billy Bean. He didn't.
Oh my God.
He didn't go against him at all, really. And then fucking Aaron Sorkin comes along and he's like, you're the bad guy. I don't care that.
Yeah, you need to be the bad guy. Really we need conflict.
And actually, my dad, who never has an opinion about movies, really, I told him about Moneyball and he's like, you know what? They really screwed over Art Howe. I don't like that film. And I was like, Dad, you don't even watch baseball. How do you know who Art Howe is? He's like, I know.
Oh my God, that's such a dad move. Oh, that's so funny. But yeah, it's that interesting thing where, I mean, even Phil, in the way he says, I play Art Howe, but not really Art Howe. Like, he's a little bit doing some PR there to make sure it's like, yes, I play someone who is real, but this is not like them. I don't want to smear this person.
Right, like he's trying to avoid a lawsuit for the movie, but also
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's this, so few scenes, so few lines, but such a presence, such a negative, such an obstacle, like such a powerful obstacle in Billy Bean's way that is truly immovable. Like Art never gives in. He never gives in. Billy just has to basically come up with a new tactic of, fine, I'm going to go around you. I'm going to trade off the players. I'm going to roster the team in a way that forces you to use these underdog statistical methods that I believe are going to work. That's something else I wanted to ask you. How much do you know? I was doing a little bit of reading on this sort of approach to statistics and baseball and whatever. Have you looked into that much, or are you like a baseball fan?
I am not a baseball fan at all. I think it's incredibly boring. I don't know why we watch the sport.
And yet Moneyball.
But I love the film, and I'm going to watch any documentary about sports, including baseball documentaries. But I don't actually know. I have a general understanding of what they're talking about when they're talking about the statistics for this. And I think that's really fascinating, but I have not read the book yet.
Okay.
Although I've read that author's other books, which I really love.
Oh, cool. Very cool. So I wanted to ask you, we've kind of broken down the Hoffman performance and talked about the presence that's there, which is so compelling to me, and his ability to act in between the lines and fill all these empty spaces with so much subtext, so much emotion, so much feeling. Jonah Hill speaks to it. You're every single day you're writing, or most days you're writing, you're working on plays, you're working on projects, you're working on pilots. How the heck, like, how do you write for presence? How does Aaron Sorkin or whoever the hell wrote this, write this character and just hope that the actor fills the space properly? Because, and I've experienced this as an actor, sometimes it's not all there, or you can't find it, and you have to fill in some gaps. And Phil is like a known gap filler. He's done some not great movies, but he has gone above and beyond to fill in the narrative gaps with amazing acting. This doesn't seem like that, though. This seems like this character was written to be this solid presence. So I'm interested in your perspective as a writer. How do you think about the actor? How do you help the actor? But if you also want a character like Art Howe, who doesn't say as much, how the hell do you do that?
You know, I feel like I struggle with that a lot as a playwright, because when I'm writing, there are moments that I'll get to in a play where I'll think, okay, I really want this moment to be understated, and I don't want to, you know, have to like spell out exactly what's happening in the moment, because I know that when we're watching it, it'll play itself out.
Right.
The problem though,
if it's acted correctly.
Right. The problem though is that like I'll be sending my plays out to people that I don't know. They don't know my work. They don't know me. And so like, they can read these moments and they won't understand them. So I feel like I'm forced to spell things out sometimes and make them a little too overt than I would want them to be. And so like when we actually get into a reading, that moment won't work as well as I want it to. So like here's an example is like, you know, in the podcast we just did in Little Montgomery,
when
I first sent that play out to, this theater that was going to do a reading of it.
Let me just pause you really quick. So for those of you who don't know, Steve and I collaborated recently on a podcast, a narrative scripted series podcast called Little Montgomery. I will put that in the show notes. Steven wrote it. I directed and produced it through my theater company down here. It is awesome. I think it's awesome. And you'll get a sense for Steven's writing. So that will be in the show notes for all of you to look at. But yes, continue. You sent that script out to theaters.
So the note that I got back a lot, one from the theater and then from my like good friends who also read the play, is they're like, it's a good play. This draft really works. I think you can cut the character Patty though. And what? And like they all said that. They're like, Patty doesn't really work. I don't really understand her. I don't understand what she's doing in the play. And I was like, are you crazy? Like Patty is one of my favorite characters. And
God, the comedy.
And they're like, okay, like, well, you can keep him for like the reading and we'll just see how the reading goes. The thing is I wrote that part for my friend Talara. Her name's Talara Harms. She's an absolutely hilarious actress. I wrote another part for her in another play I wrote called The Tourists. She's also good in. But we did the reading and she went up there and just killed it. And afterward, every single person who naysayed her was like, she's my favorite part the entire show. And so like sometimes it's very difficult when you're writing, because especially if you're writing for a specific person, you will underwrite them because you know the actor is going to fill in so many of the gaps on the page with their presence. But the problem is like, if you don't already have, you know, a contract for that play or that screenplay to be produced or seen, it'll come off as an incomplete script. So it's very hard sometimes if you don't already have something that has the green light.
That is, I don't know why I've never thought through. Well, I obviously because I'm not a writer, but that particular issue, that is astounding to me. Like, it is so hard then to break in. Like, how do you prove you're a good writer when so often an actor is what proves that you're a good writer? You know, even if the character is quote unquote fully or coherently written and it's all in the text, like an actor could still tank it. You know, they could still approach it the wrong way, or a director could not grasp it. It's like, oh my gosh, that is fascinating to think about. And that's such a good story too, because that Patty character is, God, she's amazing.
Right. She's absolutely great. And I'm sure someone like Annie Baker, a lot of her plays, if you don't know her style before you read a play of hers, it's hard to immediately understand what she's doing in the play.
Yep.
Like I remember before she, you know, was Annie Baker, I was interning at this theater company and she had just written Circle Mirror Transformation and was sending it out. Mm. And the theater company I was working at, they rejected it because they were like, this isn't very good. And then the theater right next door produced it, which was Playwrights Horizons. And it was, you know, the biggest smash hit of that year, that entire year.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And so I feel like, you know, it's very hard sometimes if you don't have the right people to read your work who have the kind of agency to give you a production.
Now, this goes back to that collaborators thing, which we've talked about on this podcast so much of like, especially when you're coming up, you know, it's hard to get noticed by people who are 10, 20, 30, 40 years ahead of you in their career, which I felt very early on and which like immediately sort of energized me as a person in my 20s to just start my own things. It's like, I don't want to be pigeonholed as an actor. I don't want to be just in line to hopefully get a part. I want to create opportunities for myself as an artist and do that with a group of friends. And from doing, I mean, it's been a fucking nightmare at times, like almost impossible to accomplish. But the collaborations that we've had, and like, we're all starting to get a little older and I'm meeting new people. I'm meeting new writers like you who we've done two projects together now. And it's like, that like cultivating those relationships and continuing to work for each other and with each other. I mean, that's like the only way I know how to do it, because I don't really trust might be the wrong word, but it's like, you have to make your own break. You know, the Duplass brothers, and they have this book Like Brothers, which is, have you read it? It's so good.
Oh no, but I really,
okay. You will love this book. It's like their memoir of kind of their whole filmmaking thing and a lot of great filmmaking lessons in it and whatnot. They have this line in there, and Mark Duplass has a talk about this on YouTube too, I believe. But the line is, the cavalry is not coming. You know, it's like, there is no one who's going to just like show up and bring your career to its next heights. It's like, my experience so far is it's from the friendships, it's from the collaborators who you work with multiple times, and it's from just manifesting your own opportunities by sheer will and a little bit of luck, and God, just like trying to be good to people, you know, not burning bridges, putting people above everything else, and maybe one day one of us breaks and helps the rest of us. You know what I mean? It's like, that's kind of how it works, I feel like.
Yeah, and I think like even more important than like one of us breaking, it's that we break as a group, right?
Oh God, wouldn't that be cool?
Getting to experience our podcast together and seeing you interact as a director with all of these actors who you've worked with for so long, it was like you skip like 8 steps in the rehearsal process. Because everyone speaks the same language, you know?
Yeah.
Like that was like, that's a piece of advice somebody gave me a long time ago, is they were like, find your tribe, you know, every time you go to cast a reading of yours, you don't want to have to like go through auditions, ask recommendations. You want to have your go-to people who are going to come in and hit it out of the park. And I remember I experienced that with, like, this was actually a different reading of the play version of our podcast, where there's another guy who plays Chet just as well as you do. He's another actor who also.
That's your nice way of saying he's better than me. It's fine. It's fine. He can be better. But Dave is mine, man. Dave is mine.
So this guy's name is, his name is Eric Folks. I actually think
fuck you, Eric Folks.
You would get along really well with him. But we were doing a reading, cool. Like 3 days of rehearsals, and he was someone who could only be there for 2 hours of rehearsal out of 3 days. And the director kept being like, are we sure we don't want somebody else? And I was like, don't worry about it. He's going to show up. He's going to understand it. And he'd never read the play before. And he showed up. And in 2 hours, he just like, he understood all of it. He was great. Yes. And we had no problems whatsoever. And I was like, that's why you need to find the people who understand your work.
Yep. Yep. And I think that I think, you know, my brain is like scaffolding like crazy right now. I think that's so essential and valuable, particularly early in your career. Then I think if you do find yourself in positions of influence, power, whatever the right word is, it's then being willing and open to expanding your circle. Because I think there's a flip side to this where it's just like, I'm going to work with the same people over and over and over, and I'm only going to work with these people and everyone else sucks. And that's not good for the future of the art. That's not good for having equitable and inclusive workspaces. So it's like, particularly the people who are leading, you know, I don't expect this from someone who's just like, I'm an actor, or, you know, I just do the one thing and I get hired out, and yes, I have my groups, but like, I feel the responsibility to continually expand and morph those collaborative circles. And yes, I'm going to have my friends who we work together on things because it's easy and it's quick and there's a shorthand and you can do it for cheaper, honestly, and there's not always the resources there. But we all, I think, also have to be looking to the horizon and say, there's more room at this table. We can make the table bigger. We can build more legs. There's more room at this table.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You can't start Pena first tonight. You'll have to start Hatterberg.
Yeah, I don't want to go 15 rounds, Billy. The lineup card is mine, and that's all.
Okay, the lineup card is definitely yours. I'm just saying you can't start Pena first.
Well, I am starting him at first.
I don't think so. He plays for Detroit now.
You traded Pena?
Thank you for listening to That's That. Please remember to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. It'll help get the podcast out there to more PSH lovers. We are a weird and strange and wonderful group of people who are obsessed with this actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman. But there's more of us, and they don't know about this podcast, and I would love to go on this journey with some more people. We'll see you next time for an in-depth look into the 2002 drama comedy-ish Love, Liza, featuring a mid-career Philip Seymour Hoffman in the leading role. Big deal. Oh, love this film. Here is the logline from IMDb. Following the unexplained suicide of his wife, Liza, a web designer turns to gasoline fumes and remote control airplanes while avoiding an inevitable conflict with his mother-in-law. Played by Kathy Bates. Love, Liza is currently streaming on Amazon Prime, and I will link it in the show notes for your convenience. My guest will be friend, playwright, and fellow movie lover, Luis Roberto Herrera. That's That is sponsored by One County Film, an independent film company telling stories with authentic characters and unique settings. You can rent our debut feature film, Palace, on Amazon right now. Check us out on YouTube as well, where we talk about Criterion films. You can check out our blog on our website, where we talk about movies and filmmaking and blah, 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 blah. We are cool, I swear. That's That is produced by me, Timothy Mark Davis, and edited by Ryan Arnst. Our show music was composed and edited by Jessica Ray Huber, and our graphic was designed by Drew Hannigan. You can connect with One County Film on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all at One County Film. You can connect with me on Twitter at Timothy Mark Dav, Timothy Mark D-A-V, and Instagram at Timothy Mark Davis. For real, send me a DM. Let's talk Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm always down to chop it up with a fellow fan. Steven, where can the people find you if you'd like to be found? Where and how can we experience your work? We talked about the podcast already, so people definitely go check that out. It'll be in the show notes. What's coming up? What do you want to plug? Website? Whatever it is, give us the Steven Ferran Smith pitch.
Well, I had a bunch of plays that were scheduled to be produced this year, and all of them were canceled. So, nothing right now.
You picked an amazing time for your career to finally take off, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. We're taking off, and we're landing immediately.
Yeah, it's time to watch Moneyball three times, you know what I mean?
But I did just update my website, so that's something that I did. And I'm pretty sure the domain name is StephenBrownPlaywright.com.
Yeah, it is that. I've gone to it many times.
Oh, really? Oh, great. You're my third visitor.
Yeah, I have been. I've linked it to many, many things many a time. I've been on it. This amazing picture of you. I don't know if you even saw that, but when we did our interview episode for the podcast, we like cut out this picture and put it as the audio graphic. You're not on Instagram and stuff. So I'll send you a screenshot so you can feel cool about it.
Aw, thanks, man.
Yeah. Okay, so website, we will definitely link that in the show notes. Are you on social media, really?
I'm on Facebook.
You're on Facebook.
Because I'm 50 years old, and that's it. But my Facebook...
He's like a real writer.
...posts that my mom makes about me. So I'm not very active, unfortunately.
You're not. I tag you in things, and you never respond, so I know you never go on there. Good for you.
I don't. I'm sorry.
No, that's good. I'm on there. Never start a business. That's what I'll say to that. All right. So we will link your website. If people want to read your play, they can listen to the podcast. If they want to read your plays, they can find out info on your website. Maybe if they're a producer or something, they can shoot you an email through the contact sheet on your website. All that good stuff. Y'all, Steven is an outstanding writer. He's probably my favorite writer of like a person who I know because I'm just nobody. But like, I love his writing. I've got to act in and be a part of two of his projects. So definitely go check out his work and throw some support his way. Steven, before we leave, I need the guest to quote Adam Sandler from Punch Drunk Love in a line he says to Dean Trumbull, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the line is, I'd say that's that, Mattress Man.
Do you just want me to repeat the line or do you want me to say the whole line?
Do you know the whole line?
I think the line is like, so like walk away before I like beat your ass to death or something. And then he said, say that's that Mattress Man.
It's definitely the subtext.
Yeah.
That's that, everybody.